This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Nothing is more important than getting a good night's sleep, and when you don't get the rest you need, your whole day is thrown off. That's why it's so important to choose the right mattress. Sleeping on a Purple mattress is truly a unique experience, because Purple mattresses are made with a gel flex grid. The gel flex grid is an innovative material that moves with your body to relieve pressure in areas like knees and hips, and support in others like your back. It feels soft where you want it and supports where you need it. Purple mattresses instantly adapt when you move. You don't sink in and get stuck like with memory foam. And thanks to over 1,400 air chambers in the gel flex grid, you will sleep cooler on a Purple mattress. Purple has a wide variety of mattresses, from the original Purple mattress to the Restore Hybrid Collection that combines GelFlex Grid with coils, and the Rejuvenate Luxe Collection, the height of luxury, with over 112,000 five-star reviews to prove it. Visit purple.com to find the perfect purple for you and enter code PODCAST10 to get 10% off.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
This podcast contains graphic descriptions of sensitive subject matter dealing with violence, death, and self-harming behavior. If you or someone you know is in crisis, call 988.
KYW News Radio Original Podcasts.
Think about what you could do with a child in 3 to 5 minutes. Make them pancakes. Walk them to school, read them a book, give them a kiss, turn out the lights. 3 to 5 minutes. That's how long it took for Ruth DiRienzo Whitehead to wrap a belt around the neck of her 11-year-old son Matthew and choke him to death while he slept in her bed on a cool April night in 2023. Then she locked the bedroom door behind her before walking barefoot through her home in suburban Philadelphia, still in her pajamas, got in her 2019 black Toyota Highlander, and drove off. When police discovered Ruth the next morning, standing in front of her family's shore house 120 miles away, there was no resistance. She cooperated and admitted to the killing. It's a horrifying story.
A child is found dead in Horsham this morning. Authorities investigating what happened.
His mother's vehicle is located in the water more than 100 miles away in Cape May. Wildwood Crest police then take her into custody. And as investigators determine what happened, there have been no arrests.
To think that someone is capable of taking a belt to their child's neck and strangling them is makes you sick.
Ruth hadn't been acting like herself in the days and weeks leading up to the murder, that much was clear. But no one saw something like this coming. Not Ruth's friends, not her family, not her husband, Matthew's father, who she'd been on the rocks with before the murder because of money problems. Ruth had always been a loving mother. She would never lay a finger on Matthew.
Every piece of evidence that we had around the time of the offense showed that she knew what she was doing was wrong. She was researching homicide before she killed her son.
The defendant would have had to have held that belt on his throat for 15 seconds for him to lose consciousness while he saw stars and lost hearing and felt pain. What were his final moments? Was he looking at her? Was he realizing that it was his mom? Was he scared because he didn't know?
In mid-February 2024, DiRienzo Whitehead was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. But a verdict is just that, a verdict. We still don't have a real answer. We're still left to wonder, what was Ruth thinking? Was she mentally ill? A loving mother pushed to the brink? Did she snap? Or Did Ruth do the unthinkable? Did she murder Matthew out of retribution? Did she purposefully kill an innocent child just to get back at her husband for the financial trouble she felt he brought to the family?
There is no other explanation other than mental illness, with all due respect to the court and the Commonwealth, that explains how a mother who loves her son that much can think that this was the way to solve all his problems and her problems.
When you actually look at things through the objective lens, you see that this was very calculated and cold, and this was a first-degree murder case.
We miss Matthew tremendously. Wonderful, beautiful boy who paid the ultimate price in this tragedy.
I'm Jim Melwort. From KYW News Radio Original Podcasts, this is Ruth DiRienzo Whitehead, The Mother, The Monster, Part 1. When we taped this podcast in early March, it had been less than 2 weeks since Ruth, now 51, was found guilty of first-degree murder by a judge in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, a suburb of Philadelphia. She was transferred to prison where she'll serve a mandatory life sentence. We obviously know how all of this ends, but the question that still lingers, even after the verdict, did Ruth's crime fit first-degree murder and a mandatory life sentence? Did she act with intent? Or was there an argument to be made for an insanity and mental health defense? It's a really complicated story. In recent days, we sat down with attorneys from both sides, and we're going to unpack some very key moments from Ruth's life and her crime. We want you to decide for yourself. Was Ruth a good mother who snapped? Or was she more of a monster who murdered her son out of malice, out of rage, resentment, and revenge, all directed at one person, her husband? I spent parts of the last 10 months covering this case. I was in the courtroom for the trial. Cameras aren't allowed in the courtroom in Pennsylvania, so you can't record video or audio. All of the following information was presented as fact during Ruth's trial and is taken from my notes in court. Let's start with Ruth's life before the crime. Ruth, her husband Dan, and their son Matthew lived in a single-family rancher in the township of Horsham, about 20 minutes north of Philadelphia. It's a well-off neighborhood. Not rich, but well-off, comfortable. She was a realtor, graduated from Drexel University in Philadelphia, and she was described by family, her brother, described her as always very positive. She would see the good in the world and made others feel better about themselves. Ruth's stepsister, Deborah Serban, vouched for her character during testimony, saying that Ruth was an amazing mother. She nursed Matthew until he was 3 years old, and they had a very close bond. She told a story about when Matthew was younger, that Ruth would pull over on the side of the road if they passed a construction site because he loved to watch the truck. She'd sit there for as long as a half an hour. Deborah said she believed Matthew was the child he was because of how Ruth treated him. Even Daniel Whitehead, Ruth's husband, admitted on record that Ruth loved Matthew unconditionally. We heard that Ruth was lenient with Matthew, that she didn't punish him much, that she gave him a long leash, which makes it that much more difficult for Ruth's loved ones to comprehend. How does unconditional love mutate into such an unspeakable act like filicide, the murder of your own child with a belt, while he slept in your bed? About a year or year and a half before Ruth killed Matthew, troublesome forces and circumstances were stacking up. The weight created a mounting pressure that ultimately became too much for her to bear. Defense attorney Eugene Tenari of Philadelphia represented Ruth during her trial. He and I spoke just a few days after Ruth was given the life sentence for first-degree murder.
There was no history in terms of any criminal activity, in terms of any violence towards others, certainly not towards her son, that would indicate that she was a risk for doing this.
Because of that, Tenari positioned the defense's case around insanity and Ruth's mental health. She didn't deserve first-degree murder, he argued. There was plenty of evidence and testimony that she loved Matthew. As he put it, how else could you explain what she did other than insanity? As Tenere prepared for trial, he focused on four main stressors that he felt were directly responsible for Ruth's downward spiral. 1, the family's finances. 2, Ruth being the sole caretaker for her mother, who was diagnosed with dementia. 3, the onset of Ruth's menopause. And 4, Ruth having to sell a shore house in Wildwood Crest, New Jersey, to give the family a financial lifeline.
Initially, she was seen by one of our experts right after her arrest to determine her competency, and there were issues with that. And then, of course, she was interviewed again by another expert for the trial, psychiatrist. And we quickly learned from both of those doctors that she was severely depressed. And I said, well, what kind of stressors were out there that would cause this type of severe depression to manifest itself into this act?
Packaged together, these four factors would make it impossible for Matthew to live a good, comfortable life. At least that's how Ruth saw it. That's why Tenere argues that she decided to kill Matthew, to spare him that life of hardship. In this section of the story, I'm going to go through and unpack the four stressors in Ruth's life one by one to paint the picture of what pushed her to the brink. First, the family finances. The main problem underscoring all of the other issues in the DiRanzo-Whitehead family. Ruth's husband, Dan, was struggling financially. His father had a life insurance business where he worked, but his father had stepped back from the business in 2019 and had passed away in the early 2020s. And after the pandemic and after Dan took it over, the business was failing. A big pressure point here became Matthew's tuition at Germantown Academy, an elite private school outside Philadelphia near their home, which cost nearly $40,000 a year for a sixth grader. Daniel said during trial, "We agreed to do anything we could to educate him."
Monies were being depleted, unbeknownst to her, by her husband to the tune of in excess of a couple hundred thousand dollars, and that caused her severe mental anguish.
Deborah Serban, the stepsister, caught wind of problems around Easter last year. When she called to set up time to drop off an Easter basket for Matthew, Ruth brought up their financial problems, which Deborah said was out of the ordinary as the two never talked about money. Deborah went on to say when she stopped by to drop off the Easter basket, Matthew sat on the couch and played video games, which Deborah said was out of character for him. She described him as usually very talkative and outgoing with adults. Money also came up in a call between Ruth and her brother, Dimitri DiRienzo. He said in testimony, Ruth had told him Dan had spent a significant amount of their money from the retirement fund to pay bills without telling her. It brought Ruth to tears. So money was stressor number one. Number two was Ruth's mother. She suffered from dementia and lived in the DiRienzo-Whitehead family home in Horsham.
Rather than putting her in a nursing home, she sacrificed a lot in terms of time and effort required to care for someone like that.
Ruth was the sole caretaker for her mother. She had to bathe and feed her, which limited her ability to work. According to testimony, Ruth's mom really started showing signs of dementia not long after Ruth's dad died in 2016. And in the year or two before the murder, her condition significantly deteriorated. Deborah Serban, the stepsister, said it was really wearing on Ruth. Her mom would ask the same question about 10 times in 2 minutes. According to Ruth's brother, Dimitri, as they were growing up, their mom often said, "When I get older, you can't put me in a home. You have to let me live with you." Ruth felt like she could never leave the house. She felt trapped and that she had to fulfill her mother's wishes. Stressor number three was menopause. Eugene Tenere, the defense attorney, acknowledged this is a sensitive subject. All women go through menopause, but few commit murder. Menopause, though, affected her mood. She said she started menopause a year before the murder. Started hearing voices, didn't have rational thoughts, insomnia, heat flashes. And she Googled whether menopause could cause depression.
What we were saying is menopause is oftentimes associated with depression. I mean, that's well known. So I didn't just pull this out of the air and say, hey, let's use menopause. She had seen a doctor for it. Was it the sole root and cause of this? Absolutely not. What we tried to show the court was the depression caused irrational thinking, delusions, to the point where she believed in her mind that the killing of her son was benefiting him.
Dimitri DiRienzo testified Ruth had been seeing a doctor because how menopause was making her feel. But at no point did Dimitri catch wind that catastrophic forces were brewing. I spoke with him outside the courtroom before the sentencing hearing started.
It's difficult to see what you see in everyday life and interactions and equate them to what's actually happening in the human mind, right? Like, I think that's like, you know, seeing her express, you know, being upset about things or just being, you know, sad about things, to recognize that these were the red flags, or just we just didn't have awareness for that. And that's the difficult aspect of it. So it's just making those correlations, I think, is tough to do.
Ruth's thoughts kept getting darker. In early 2023, evidence from her cell phone showed she started Googling ways to kill herself. In March, about a month before Matthew's murder, Ruth had a lunch date with friends. One of the friends testified that she noticed a change in Ruth's behavior, described her as spiraling, described the lunch as uncomfortable, said mood swings were clearly affecting her, described her as agitated, said she didn't seem like herself and looked like she was going to cry. During the lunch, Ruth even snapped at one of the friends, something the group talked about as out of character, after she left.
That depression wasn't just caused by the menopause. It wasn't just caused by solely the problems in dealing with her mom, and it wasn't caused by any one of those individually, but the combination is what created this severe depression. The depression then, to the extent where you're trying to kill yourself, I don't know of any other depression that could be more severe than that, created the Google searches, created the problems, created the irrational thinking, and created the delusional belief that what she was doing, in an altruistic sense, was the right thing to do.
So we've covered Ruth was growing overwhelmed by financial problems, caring for her mother, and menopause. The fourth and final stressor, the factor that everyone, from the defense, the prosecution agreed was the last straw, was the family shore house in Wildwood Crest. The property was cozy, three beds, three baths, 1,300 square feet, but well furnished, about three blocks from the boardwalk. If you're not familiar with the Jersey Shore, a property like this can fetch nearly $1 million. Ruth had been given the house by her family. Dimitri DiRienzo, her brother, said the house had been in the family since he and Ruth were kids, around the time Ruth was 13, and the family spent a lot of summers there. Even though Ruth herself was a realtor, she used someone else to list the house. It was emotionally painful for her. She was extremely attached to the property, but given the family's financial situation, the house became an asset they couldn't sit on anymore. They had to sell it. The Friday before the murder, a realtor sent a blast text to his list of clients. He'd done business with Ruth in the past. The text said it was a hot market and now was a good time to sell. Ruth responded, saying she had no idea what the property was worth. When the realtor told her they could list it for about $800,000, Ruth was surprised, telling him, "That's a crazy number." The two traded texts and emails over the weekend, eventually signing the listing agreement on April 10th, 2023. Her lawyer, Eugene Tenari, spoke about the stakes.
When that had to be sold, we believe that that was really what triggered what had already been set in place, the suicide attempts, the researching how to kill oneself, how to jump off a bridge, telling her husband two times that she wanted, already tried to kill herself. And of course, those horrible searches about how to kill people with a belt. That's where the mental health lies.
Hours later, Ruth put her husband's belt around Matthew's neck.
If you're not attuned to what was going on with Ruth, which we tried to show this court, at first glance, without delving into her mental state further, it looks as though this was premeditated, pre-planned. That is what the district attorney tried to put forth. We believe, and our experts stated from the outset, that even those searches were indicative of someone who was delusional, someone who was detached from reality, someone who couldn't comprehend the fact that there was perhaps a light at the end of the tunnel with the financial situation, But as someone who didn't have a sick mind because of this mental illness, because of her delusions, would have been able to understand and grasp. And unfortunately, all of that led to this most unfortunate occurrence.
Ruth had become consumed with this idea that Matthew could feel the pressure she and the family were under, and that she had to spare him a life of hardship. Because of the money, having to take care of her mom, menopause, and selling the Shore House, Teneri said Ruth had become blind to reality, and because of that, the seeds for tragedy had been planted. Coming up next, the disturbing details of the murder scene and why the defense felt there was enough evidence to show Ruth's crime was not of intent, but a byproduct of insanity and mental health. We'll be right back. I'm Jim Melwert, and this is Ruth DiRienzo Whitehead, The Mother, The Monster, Part 1. The day after Ruth DiRienzo Whitehead was arrested, law enforcement officials in Montgomery County met with media.
Just about everyone in our town has heard this story in one way, shape, or form. I was able to see my 11-year-old's face when we dealt with this child, and I think a lot of families start to think about, well, what if they're children? So it hits hard.
That was Horsham Township Police Chief Scott Fida. This is Montgomery County District Attorney Kevin Steele.
There's tragedy after tragedy in this. You have classmates, a father who, found his son, murdered. The community, you have the folks that have to work through this. This is a tragedy on so many levels, and I don't think words can describe the grief that everybody's going through on this.
How could an 11-year-old have known that by seeking comfort, safety, and security in his own mother's bed, he would be making a fatal decision? This was the challenge for Ruth DiRienzo Whitehead's defense attorney, Eugene Teneri. On the surface, most of the evidence was so damning and incomprehensible. And remember, innocence or guilt was never up for debate in this case. Ruth admitted what she did immediately when she first spoke to law enforcement. What Teneri was making this case about was whether or not Ruth's crime was first-degree murder, which comes with a mandatory life sentence. Teneri contended there was something deeper going on, that this crime was the manifestation of a mental break. But first, we have to establish the chain of events that happened between April 10th and April 11th, 2023. Again, all of this information came from facts presented during Ruth's trial in February 2024. Early in the morning on April 11th, Horsham Township Police were called to 505 Privet Road. It wasn't uncommon for Matthew to sleep in his parents' bed, so his dad, Dan, had slept in Matthew's room the night before. Typical for Dan's morning routine, he went to his office in the basement. When he noticed the time and didn't hear Matthew up and getting ready for school, he went upstairs and found the door to his and Ruth's bedroom locked. He couldn't get the key to work, so he went to get his tools. He noticed that garage door unlocked, which he found odd because he remembered Matthew checking it before they went to bed. He also realized the family car wasn't in the garage. He went back to the bedroom and took the handle off the door and found his son lying on his stomach, unresponsive, clearly dead. Dan screamed and called 911. The first officer on scene described what she found in greater detail in court, making it hard to fathom Dan's grief after finding the boy. She described Dan as extremely distraught. Ruth was nowhere to be found. Horsham police notified other law enforcement to be on the lookout for that family car. They got a call from Cape May police while they were still at the home on Privet Road. The 2019 Toyota Highlander had been found in the ocean. From what investigators pieced together, Matthew was killed at some point between 9:30 p.m. Monday, April 10th, and 1:30 a.m. Tuesday, April 11th, 2023. The findings of the medical examiner, Dr. Victoria Sorkin, were brutal. She testified it would take about 5 pounds of pressure to constrict the blood vessels in the neck, about 10 to 15 seconds for Matthew to go unconscious, brain damage would set in after about 2 to 3 minutes, and it would take about 3 to 5 minutes for the brain to be beyond repair and to cause his death. Before investigators left the home in Horsham, they noticed one more thing. On the island in the kitchen, clipped together next to the screwdriver Dan had used to get into the bedroom, was Matthew's latest report card, a photo of him from his first birthday, and a letter he'd written to his mother a couple years earlier that said, "Dear Mom, I am grateful for you because you wake me up so I am not late for school. Also, you make me lunch so I am not hungry at school. I am grateful you are my mom. Love, Matthew." Around the same time all this was going on at the Privet Road home, Cape May police were looking into what happened to the car they'd found in the ocean that matched the info Horsham police had put out. Inside the car, responding officers found a phone and a wallet in the center console. At trial, they played video showing the 2019 Toyota Highlander going west on Lafayette Street in Cape May around 3:15 a.m., then onto the beach, then into the waves at 3:28. Ruth sits in the vehicle for about 9 minutes before she gets out and walks up the beach in bare feet, wearing the pajamas she'd gone to bed in the night before. As they were connecting the car in the ocean in Cape May, about 3.5 miles away, Wildwood Crest police found Ruth at their family shore house, 5704 Seaview Avenue. She was standing on the sidewalk in front of the home that she'd just put up for sale hours earlier, which everyone said was the final straw. As Officer Michael McInerney approached her, video from his body camera showed her say, "I know what I did." It was the first time Ruth was on record admitting to murdering her son. According to documents and testimony, Ruth didn't show much emotion when she was processed at the Cape May County Correctional Facility, but she again acknowledged the murder, saying, "I should not have done what I did." Her clothes were taken as evidence, and Ruth was put in what's called a suicide smock to prevent her from harming herself. Her interview with investigators gave the first clues about why she killed Matthew. The family was having financial problems. Matthew was upset. She was worried he wouldn't have a good life, so she strangled him. Ruth was taken back to Montgomery County. At the time, District Attorney Kevin Steele told us what he knew. This is from April 12, 2023, outside the Montgomery County Courthouse.
"I don't think any of us can help look at this on a human level. I mean, I got a 12-year-old. To think that someone is capable of taking a belt to their child's neck and strangling them it makes you sick, you know, because, you know, this is really difficult. I had a friend call me yesterday and say, you know, what do you say to the kids? And I don't have an answer for that."
Within hours of his client's arrest, Eugene Tenari, Ruth's lawyer, was already pointing to mental health concerns. This is what he told us in an interview on April 14th, 2023.
"Mental health is a very complex area when you're dealing with that and with individuals. I don't want to answer why people did not do anything. And I'm not saying she didn't have some help and didn't seek some help. When individuals may start to spiral or exhibit symptoms of psychosis, Sometimes people don't recognize it right away, even if they're close to them. I mean, you can still function. You can still drive a car. You can still cook a meal despite having these thoughts or these premonitions or hallucinations or delusions that unfortunately manifest themselves sometimes."
DA Steele had a different opinion.
"We're very confident in, you know, the evidence that we've established and put together At this point, from that end, you know, it looks fairly straightforward for us.
During the period between Ruth's arrest in April 2023 and trial in February 2024, she was held at the Montgomery County Correctional Facility in Eagleville, Pennsylvania. On January 12, 2024, Ruth and her lawyer Eugene Tenari elected to have a bench trial rather than trial by jury, meaning a judge would decide her level of guilt. Opening statements began a month later, on February 12th at the Montgomery County Courthouse in Norristown. It was a somber mood in the hallway outside and in the courtroom, Ruth's family sitting on one side, Dan's family and supporters sitting on the other. There often aren't opening statements in a bench trial, but Tenari laid out his case.
In anticipation of what the district attorney was going to try and show, that this was born out of anger, frustration, resentment, hatred of her husband, I undertook the task of trying to determine whether that was true, whether she had anger issues, whether she was someone who flew off the handle, whether her temperament was such that it would cause her to do this. And to every person I spoke to, they indicated that was not her. To me, clear that this occurred as a result of something that went wrong in her mind. Some type of mental health issue triggered this.
The prosecution went first and called over a half dozen witnesses to the stand to lay out how the crime was committed, how Matthew died, and what Ruth did, and where she went after she killed him. Many of the details we just covered. One of the more dramatic moments of the trial came during the first day when Daniel Whitehead took the stand. A somewhat large and imposing figure, Daniel had to pause not long after being sworn in when he was asked where he lived, and he said 505 Privet Road. Both he and Ruth broke down, shaking from sobs. We'll dive more into Daniel in part two of the podcast, but in his testimony, he gave a glimpse into what life was like before it all went wrong. He described Matthew as your typical 11-year-old. As he put it, a great kid in sixth grade at Germantown Academy, was doing well in school, always happy, always smiling. He loved swimming, water polo, and baseball, and playing video games, and the Phillies. Dan made it clear how much he loved and cared for Ruth, but talked about some of the struggles they faced in recent years, pressures raising their child, taking care of her mother, and keeping their son in Germantown Academy with tuition nearly $40,000 a year. Dan detailed what he did for work and the tough times he'd fallen on in recent years, and how they were linked to the problems at home. He said Ruth was often mad, and there were lots of discussions about their financial situation with Matthew present. Dan would reply, "I know we're in a tough situation, but we'll work through it, seeing the other side of the financial problems." Prosecutors asked Daniel to recount Matthew's final day. He said he stayed home from school that day. Dan wanted him to go, but Ruth let him stay home to ride with her, taking his aunt to the airport. But Dan says Matt was normal that day, went for a bike ride, played video games, and was excited about a baseball game he had the next day. The night before, they were out to dinner with Matthew's aunt when Matthew got upset and started crying. Ruth accused Dan of making Matthew cry because of their financial situation, but Daniel says Matthew was actually mad because he wanted to play something with friends on the computer, but they made him go to dinner. While Dan had seen a change in his wife for many of the reasons we've already discussed, he had no indication of what was about to happen. I want to pause here and sort of take a step back. This was such an intense part of the trial. We're talking about Dan, Ruth, and Matthew like they're characters in the story, and in a way they are. But we also have to remember that these are real lives we're dealing with, real people. There's nothing contrived about the heartbreak that happened here. Covering courts, you see people at their worst days, not only the defendants, but also the people who care about them and the people who they've affected through their crimes. You learn how to keep it at arm's length. You learn how to not let it affect you so you don't take it out of the courtroom, take it home, or let it eat at you. There are moments, however, where things get through that armor. Seeing Dan ripped your heart out. To hear him initially talk about how much he cared about Ruth before this happened, how much he loved her, how close they were, you really got a feel for the family unit that he had, that his wife and his son were his world. There were moments where he looked in her direction and you could see the rage. As a parent, you just can't help feeling some of that emotion. And I don't think I was the only one in the courtroom that felt that way. It was a moment. Whether or not it was inferred or real, you couldn't help feeling that there was a certain level of guilt on his part for the financial situations, things out of his control, the pandemic, his business. And he had pulled money, significant amount of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars out of their retirement fund without telling Ruth. And Ruth found out about it. And that didn't go over well. We'll explore more of that in part two. But Ruth's lawyer, Eugene Tenari, pointed out what he saw as the weaknesses in where prosecutors were going, that the murder of Matthew was because of anger, resentment, and revenge directed at Daniel.
The Commonwealth was trying to say, well, it was done out of anger. You don't kill your son just because you're angry at your husband. There's other ways around it. Someone who could think rationally and was able to comprehend the fact that, yeah, I could sell this house at the shore and we would be out of debt and it wouldn't be a problem. You can think that way. I can think that way. But we weren't suffering from a psychotic, major depressive disorder with psychotic features with suicidal ideation. You look at it, to me, you have an individual who was a college graduate, Ruth, from Drexel University, worked as a realtor for a prominent real estate firm. So we're not talking about an individual who is not that intelligent, very smart. So then what clouded her mind, a smart individual, college graduate, realtor, to think that that was the way to go? Because I'm angry, I'm going to kill my son? Had this been anything other than mental illness, and that an individual who is as smart as her would have figured it out and been able to get out of this without killing her son.
Daniel Whitehead was on the stand for the better part of the day. Montgomery County Detective Heather Long was next. It was during this stage of the trial that Long's taped interview with Ruth the morning she was taken into custody in Wildwood Crest on April 11th, 2023, was submitted as evidence and played back in the courtroom. Ruth broke down, shrieking, sobbing, saying she couldn't watch. They paused the video and Ruth agreed to allow them to play the video without her in the courtroom. She was taken back to a holding cell. Once Ruth was taken from the courtroom and the video resumed, we saw Detective Long explain her rights to Ruth and ask her if she suffered from any mental health disorders. DiRenzo Whitehead answered, about a year ago when she started menopause, she heard voices in her head and she didn't have rational thoughts. She referenced her husband's business, in her words, blowing up, and her son getting depressed, saying, I know these are no reasons to kill a child, and I did that. In the video, it was hard to understand as Ruth started crying to the point she almost couldn't talk. Ruth asked Detective Long to just send her to prison, saying, just send me there. Detective Long, I'm a monster. I'm a really good mom. I don't know what happened. Ruth again talked about Matthew's concerns of the financial issues, saying she knew he was upset, telling her she never smiles anymore and is always so sad, saying he's such a good kid. He was such a sweet kid. I can't get him back. She said as they went to bed that night, Matthew was crying, and he kept crying, repeating, he kept crying over and over again, saying he fell back to sleep, and then I killed him. I strangled him. She said she got out of bed, grabbed one of her husband's belts, and wrapped it around Matthew's neck. He woke up as the belt first went around his neck, but she continued the pressure until he was dead. Asked if she knew he was dead, she said yes. Then she explained how she got her keys, got in a car, and drove to Cape May, eventually ending up in the ocean. She said she just started driving inside the ocean, and the car wasn't moving. Then the water was coming in. Then I got out, and I just started walking, eventually ending up at their beach house nearly 3.5 miles away. Ruth told Detective Long, "I should have stopped myself, but I didn't." When Long asked why she didn't, Ruth replied, "Just all this stuff going through my head. How could I do this to my kid? My God, oh my God, God, I'll be in prison for the rest of my life." Detective Long asked, "Why take it out on your son instead of taking it out on your husband?" Ruth said, "I don't know. I don't know. I should have. You know, you're right. It's his fault, not my son's fault." Dan wasn't in the courtroom during this part of the trial. Day one came to an end after the video was over, but Detective Heather Long's testimony was just getting started. On day two, she gave us a peek into Ruth's cell phone and her state of mind at the time of the murder. Prosecutors walked Detective Long through a meticulous outline of searches and texts found on Ruth's phone, including, "How long does it take to suffocate someone?" "When parents kill?" "Why do mothers kill their children?" "When is Mega Millions drawing?" "How to build a noose?" "And how quickly can you drown in the ocean?" Then, starting at 7 a.m., a flurry of searches throughout the day. Monday, April 10th, suicide off the Commodore Barry Bridge. Hair dryer and tub kill someone. 11-year-old who strangles self with belt dies. At 7:53 p.m., maybe less than 2 hours left in Matthew's life, Ruth searched how to complete suicide, then looked up heights of area bridges. On cross-examination of Detective Long, Eugene Tenari brought out that Dan had told detectives the only reason he could think Ruth wanted to kill Matthew was because she wanted to save him from living a horrible life. Tenari used that testimony to dive into the concept of altruistic maternal filicide, that a mother would kill her child to spare them some sort of pain or hardship. What is altruistic maternal filicide, and how does everything kind of lead to that?
Sure. Altruistic maternal filicide is obviously the mother killing a child out of the belief that you are killing that child for the good of the child. A classic example is if you have a child who is suffering from maybe cancer in a cancer ward, and they have incurable brain cancer, inoperable brain cancer, and the child is just getting worse and worse every single day. There's nothing that's going to save the child, to the point where you come to the conclusion that I can't take this anymore. I don't want my child to continue to suffer. And you sneak in at night and maybe you pull out the machines that are keeping he or she alive. That's altruistic in your mind. Illegal, but that's what altruistic filicide is.
What was her thought process? What was she thinking this would do? Why was this in Matthew's best interest?
It's rare, but it does happen. You usually see three factors that are occurring. One is love of the child, which I think we clearly established. Second, it's usually associated with psychosis. And third, the mothers who do this usually try and kill themselves, commit suicide. And we, I believe, established that all three of those fit. In Ruth's case, it checked all the boxes for maternal filicide in an altruistic fashion.
Tenari argued that no mother, parent, or person of sound mind could rationalize this type of logic. He also emphasized it would be stupid for someone to commit murder with other people in the house. It would be stupid if you're trying to get away with a crime to flee in pajamas and bare feet. Tenari also used one of Ruth's own justifications for the murder against her in a way to try and prove insanity. Ruth was the only one claiming Matthew wasn't happy. Everyone else thought he was content and well-adjusted. To Tenari, this was further evidence that Ruth was delusional and didn't have any idea what was going on. After a brief redirect of Heather Long, the prosecution rested. Day two continued with the first defense witness, Dimitri Di Rienzo, Ruth's brother. The defense hoped his testimony would support the narrative of Ruth as a once loving mother who'd lost her way. Dimitri, Ruth's younger brother, testified his three boys were reasonably close with Matthew. He said Ruth was proud to have a son who went to Germantown Academy. Dimitri also gave testimony that supported the defense argument that there were four major stressors in Ruth's life that led to the psychosis: finances, being the primary caregiver to her mother, menopause, enlisting the Shorehouse.
I think it's this concept of psychosis. You know, I hadn't really even understood that term or heard much about that term prior to this. Getting to that point where you're into such severe depression to where you slip into psychosis and disconnect from reality, you know, obviously the brain, it appears from what I hear and the way I understand it, the brain can do that. It can disconnect from reality in certain aspects. So like just how psychosis, I mean, it's something I'm going to continue to study myself so I can understand it. But clearly how that can cause someone to disconnect in a selective way is what I definitely learned.
Denary's final witness was an expert, psychologist Dr. Kenneth Weiss. Weiss supported the claim that Ruth's crime was a result of insanity and mental health. After spending 5 hours interviewing her and reviewing health records, Dr. Weiss gave a diagnosis at the time of the incident that it was a major depressive disorder with psychotic features and suicidal features. Denary thought Weiss's testimony successfully demonstrated Ruth's mental state met the criteria for insanity under Pennsylvania law. Therefore, Denary argued she shouldn't be charged with first-degree murder.
By all accounts, she was a loving, doting mom of Matthew that would do anything for him, including sending him to the best private school. It was beyond the normal mother-son relationship. He was her world. So knowing that, it of course, dawned upon me that clearly there's some mental issues going on here, because what other explanation could there be for this atrocity?
Prosecutors had one, and they laid it bare in the courtroom.
The part of this case that takes my breath away is thinking about this little boy going to bed with his mom that he trusts so much as a safe place, and whether he realized it was her that was killing him. What were his final moments? Was he looking at her? Was he realizing that it was his mom? Was he scared because he didn't know? That's what takes my breath away.
This is Lauren Marvel. She's one of the two lead attorneys prosecuting the case for the Montgomery County District Attorney's Office.
What she did was she took the time and the thought to set out a message for her husband. The only interpretation of this message was that she hated him and she wanted him to be in pain. And then she took his belt that she had used to strangle her son, got into their car, and drove to the town where they got married to drive into the ocean. In these cases, you have to find every scrap of insight into someone's mind that you can, because that is the critical thing in a homicide case, what someone is thinking at the time that they killed someone. All you have to prove that is their decisions just before and just after, usually.
In part two of Ruth Di Rienzo Whitehead, The Mother, The Monster, we'll get to know more about Marvel, her co-prosecutor Gwendolyn Call, and how they depicted Ruth as a vindictive killer who murdered her only son out of rage, revenge, and resentment. Ruth Di Rienzo Whitehead, The Mother, The Monster, is a production of KYW News Radio Original Podcast. Ryan Seltzer is our producer. Christina Koppeser is KYW News Radio's brand manager. Tom Rickert is KYW News Radio's director of podcasting. Kevin McCory is KYW News Radio's news director. Special thanks to KYW News Radio senior visual producer Holly Stevens, Eugene Tenari, Gwendolyn Call, and Lauren Marvel. To read more about Ruth Di Rienzo Whitehead's murder trial, check out the links in the show notes. You can follow KYW News Radio on social media at KYW News Radio and online at kywnewsradio.com. Listen to KYW News Radio original podcasts free on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your pods. I'm Jim Melwert. You can find me on social media at jmelwert. If you or someone you know is struggling with mental health or is in danger of self-harm or suicide, call 988.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Struggling with mental health shouldn't be the norm. At Mindful Therapy Group, we specialize in connecting you with compassionate therapists to find the perfect fit for you. Mindful Therapy Group accepts most health insurances. Visit mindfultherapygroup.com to start your mental health journey today.
In the fast-paced world of attacking, speed is everything. And that's where the Furon 7 Plus shines. Engineered for accuracy and precision at a rapid pace, it's your secret weapon on the pitch. Experience overall comfort and precise striking, even in the game's fastest moments. The nylon outsole, with its V-shaped stud configuration, is designed for firm ground, giving you the grip you need to outmaneuver your opponents. Step up your attacking game and learn more and purchase the Furon at NewBalance.com.